Last year, as the hospital worked on readmissions, they came to one of our regional medical director meetings with all of our facility medical directors and asked for our help with fixing readmissions. And my first reaction was, there's nothing for us to do. Once they come to the ER, their fate is sealed, and there's really nothing we can do to help that. And I did not realize that it was already determined that I would be one of those people that would lead this project for our system.
Welcome to Pemba On Demand, Physician Leaders Making a Difference. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians seeking professional development. We discuss a wide range of topics on the podcast, including successful innovations in a variety of healthcare disciplines, current issues in healthcare career development, and healthcare leadership. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries, most of whom graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. The information provided in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute professional advice. The views and opinions expressed by the host and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the University of Tennessee or any other organization. By listening to this podcast, you acknowledge and agree to these terms. Whether you're sipping your morning coffee, commuting to the hospital, or just looking for a dose of inspiration, we've got you covered. We hope you will take full advantage of these practical, insightful, and relevant discussions designed to help physician leaders get new and build upon existing leadership skills and perspectives. Pemba On Demand will allow you to be an even bigger force for good in healthcare. We have a great Pemba On Demand show for you today. My guest today is Dr. Max Baumgartner, Chief Medical Officer and current student in the University of Tennessee's Physician Executive MBA program. Max and I are going to unpack how he's tackling one of the toughest challenges in acute care, reducing emergency department readmissions while balancing quality, safety, and the patient experience. We'll talk strategy, leadership lessons from the C-suite, his decision to pursue an MBA, and how the PEMBA program shaped his approach. Stay with us. This is going to be a powerful conversation. Joining us on the show tonight.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show. I've been looking forward to your interview for some time now. So Max, let's go back in time a little bit. Maybe you could share with us what was happening in your career and your life when you really first started thinking about getting an MBA, and what led to that decision, or what were some of the factors that led to that decision?
Yeah, that's a great question, Norman. So I was a facility medical director where I ran three hospitals, and I also had a system role where I had an oversight over several other campuses within our group. And I wondered what was next, what would my next role look like? And what I noticed is that most of the people, many if not most of those people in those higher roles, all had MBAs. And so I asked them, do I need an MBA? What did you learn at an MBA? I didn't know much about it, except that I wanted to be in one of those roles, and most of those people had an MBA. So I started to ask the question, why I should get an MBA, or what would that do to help me along my role? And the overarching theme is that it will really transform you as a leader, as a person. The amount of knowledge that you'll gain there is worth almost a decade of leadership experience. And you'll learn things there that you would otherwise not have been exposed to or learned, even during your current roles.
And then, so how long did it take you to reach that decision?
I spent about 6 months talking to several leaders within our organization and within the hospital system to ask them, you know, why they did that, why they had chosen certain programs. And I was very fortunate that I came across several of my friends that actually already attended UT Pemba. And that was a really guiding light for me, was their experience, how wonderful the program was, the friends and colleagues that they met, the professional networking, and really how it had really transformed them as a leader and as an individual.
I was going to ask you how you chose the PEMBA program out of so many different options in the U.S. There's so many different executive MBA models out there.
I had looked at multiple options for an MBA, And I wanted to make sure that I wasn't checking a box to get an MBA, that I actually had learned and been transformed by the experience in the program. And so as I solicited information amongst my friends and colleagues, I spoke to people about the format, what they had learned. And there are different options for that that fits different people's lifestyles. Most of my friends that did the self-paced one told me that it took forever. It was very challenging. It took years when they thought it was going to take a year or 18 months. And every one of my friends that had attended UTPM said the time was perfect. It was a year program. The timing, the on-campus timing was perfect. And the formatting with weekends throughout the year during classes really fit their lifestyle and professional needs. So that was part of it. The other part of it was I had worked with an organization that had an affiliation with UT Pemba, and then just word of mouth solicitation really when you look this up online, it has got an amazing reputation. So all roads and influences really led me to UT Pemba. It wasn't a single person or single reference that guided me to come here.
And had you ever heard about the University of Tennessee's Physician Executive MBA program before you started actively seeking an MBA program?
I had not realized or not known about the program prior to really looking into this for myself.
Now, I wonder, can you recall, and you've still got one residency period left before you complete the program, but I wonder, was there a moment during the program when you had when you suddenly realized this is exactly why I needed this MBA?
Yeah, I'll say when I first started, just going there and meeting with everybody, it was very positive and collaborative. We did a bunch of team building exercises and work. And every time that I went had a class, well, let's take the first resident period. When I did that and came back, I applied knowledge from that within weeks of coming back. And then every class, every weekend, I had an aha moment almost every week or every 2 weeks where something that I'd learned I could apply and do something better in my current roles to support my teams. I wish I could say that it was one moment, but every time I had a class, every time that we came back from RP, I had repeat validation of why I was there. And it really empowered me to learn more and take care of my teams or lead processes better. So I wish I could give you an exact example of one time, but honestly, every time. And I'll use a parallel example for physicians. You know, in medical school, sometimes we learned information and we're like, why do I need to know this? And then, you know, fast forward to when you're in practice, you're like, boy, I wish I would have paid more attention in XYZ class. And I feel that being out in practice and going here, having some leadership experience really helped to sink in that knowledge and that those learnings and then apply them moving forward.
Can you identify a specific course or component of the PEMBA program, like finance or leadership strategy, that had the biggest impact or was more applicable to your work as a physician executive?
I can share that we'll hit a couple of those topics. So finance, at first I was a little overwhelmed would be the wrong term, but at first I was really surprised by the amount of finance and math. And I was reminded that this is an MBA program. But it really helped me to understand the finances when we have CFO reports. It really empowered me to better understand that and how you build a project and how do you understand finances. And how does that overlay with a hospital and a system? Strategy and leadership were very crucial to me. I've used those as most recently as today to talk about strategy planning for 2026. How do you build a team? How do you evaluate a process? How do you set up teams for success? How do you measure those? So I've used all of those on a weekly, daily, and monthly basis since the program or during the program.
Okay, thank you. I want to talk a little bit now, and you're going to talk more about this as we go on. I've asked you to share a little bit about your OAP project, but how did the program's focus on a doing a real world project influence the value that you took out of the program?
So one of the main goals of the program is to have a major project, an OAP project. And that parallels what a lot of leaders do in real life, which is they lead several large projects. As we learned the appropriate way to do that or proper way to lead a team and do that, I was able to take those lessons and actually apply those to the readmission project that I was helping lead and support for our local system. Part of the program involves a mentor and a leadership coach, and I was able to use those lessons and my mentor to help me not only with my project, but also with my leadership role and my local campus project as well.
And you mentioned that the OIP project that you focused on was around preventing readmissions.
That's correct.
And was that a project that you got involved in while you were already a student in Pemba, or had that program kicked off before you joined Pemba?
The original program preceded my entering the MBA program. So this program started in 2024. This readmission project has started then, but it had flourished and gained much more traction while I was in the MBA program. And so as we transition from an awareness and feedback to building processes is when I started my MBA program. And really those lessons I took back and helped to support the teams and processes that we put in place and are still in place today.
So, would you mind sharing with us a little bit about how you got involved in leading that project and what your initial reaction was to leading that project?
Sure. So my current role is Vice President, Chief Medical Officer at AdventHealth Apopka. It's a new role that I actually was fortunate to have or take while in the MBA program. My previous role was as a System and Market Director for Emergency Medicine with Team Health in Central Florida. In that role, we support AdventHealth, and it's really a symbiotic relationship that we've had for 40 plus years with the hospital system. Last year, as the hospital worked on readmissions, they came to one of our regional medical director meetings with all of our facility medical directors and asked for our help with fixing readmissions. And my first reaction was, there's nothing for us to do. Once they come to the ER, their fate is sealed, and there's really nothing we can do to help that. And shortly after I made that statement in front of a large group, I did not realize that it was already determined that I would be one of those people that would lead this project for our system. So it was a surprise to me, and it was very obvious to all those in the room that, as I seemed antagonistic about it, that I was surprised and shocked that something that I didn't think we could would something I didn't think we could impact, I would soon be one of the leaders to help lead this process.
So, Max, maybe now would be a good time for you to share with us a little bit about the OAP that you did, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, I'd be happy to discuss that.
So, kind of walk us through how you initiated this project, again, with your level of involvement and how this all kind of came to be, I guess.
So as the hospital came and spoke to the ER about how we could be involved and make an impact, we had to ask ourselves, how can the ER play a role in reducing readmissions? And we focused on those that are 65 and above. And the question was, how can the ER play a strategic role in reducing readmissions for our patients? Many people ask, why are readmissions so important? And what is a readmission? So readmissions, from our perspective, is a patient that gets discharged and comes back to the hospital and gets readmitted within 30 days. Across the country, one in six Medicare patients that's discharged is readmitted. That's a national average that affects every hospital in the country. The top performing hospitals in the country perform at a 10% level where one in 10 are readmitted. And so this is a large volume of our patients. Each year, almost 2 million patients are readmitted in the United States. It's tied to a bunch of quality and public reported data such as CMS Five Star, value-based purchasing, hospital readmission reduction program, and many insurers have ratings based off of this as a quality metric. Each year, CMS denies $520 to $530 million to hospitals due to their performance of readmissions. And then 93% of hospitals are also impacted. So almost every hospital in the country has some impact of readmissions. So to share a little bit about our system, is that we have eight campuses in Central Florida. We have eight hospital-based campuses with eight hospital-based emergency departments. We have another 8 to 10 freestanding emergency departments, about 2,500 inpatient beds, and we have an Epic electronic medical record which unites all the campuses. We've been practicing standardized discharge practices for years, which include a medication reconciliation list, early discharge follow-up within 7 days, transition specialist, remote monitoring, review of readmissions, and then a really core four specialty discharge, which is heart attack, pneumonia, COPD, and heart failure. And even with all of that work, the readmissions for a patient were not at goal for the system. And that's where they came to the ER and asked, what else can be done? Can the ER play a role? They'd never come and ask us to play a role in this before. And they said, what can you do to help us?
So where were the major initiatives focused in the hospitals before they asked the ED to become integral to this process?
If you look at our discharge processes for readmissions, or I'm sorry, readmission processes, really fell into two buckets, which was discharge excellence, or what we call discharge excellence today, and then outpatient care models, which involved home health, primary care, and other community care delivery models. So really had those two pieces, but what we didn't realize we lacked was closing the loop where the ER was part of that process to evaluate patients and share knowledge. So patients would come back to the ER and either get readmitted or get sent home, and we never captured information about those patients. Why did they come back? What happened that required them to come back to the ER 3 days after discharge? So when patients came back and got discharged, we didn't have great ways to take care of them or share that knowledge or share that information to our inpatient colleagues to let them know that that plan to send them home with home physical therapy or home health care didn't happen. They had no idea how successful they were. They just know they set it up and they discharged a patient, but they had no idea or no way of knowing how effective that was until we got involved and reviewed all of those patients.
Okay.
This is kind of a funny slide, but as we see the evolution of AI, everybody seems to lean on AI to solve all of their problems or find a solution. So out of abundance of interest, we asked ChatGPT and AI, what do you suggest based off of this? How can we prevent readmissions? How can we better care for our patients? And it came up with two answers, was to avoid coming back to the hospital and avoid readmitting them. There was not much additional substance behind that. And so when we looked at this, we said, no kidding, right? So just don't come back and don't get readmitted, and that's how you fix the problem. But it didn't tell us how to do it, what to do, or how to care for our patients. As we looked at the data across our system, what was interesting is the number one predictor of a readmission was the number of ER visits within the last 6 to 12 months. So a patient that comes to the ER 6, 7, 8 times in the last 6 or 7 months has a much higher risk of being admitted or readmitted than a patient that's a low ER utilizer. And this is for a myriad of reasons, but the causes all lead to the same result. It could be that they're extremely ill or have chronic illnesses. They could become acutely ill because of poor management at home. They could lack outpatient infrastructure. They could lack outpatient primary care, access to medications, or what's very common is social determinants of health. All of those causes led to one result, which was the number of ER visits. And so when we compared that to other predictive models such as LACE score or the Epic readmission score, we found in Central Florida that the number one risk factor was the number of ED revisits.
Do you think that number, just based on your data and your the work that you've done, do you think that that indicator or that correlation would be consistent across other hospital systems?
I think it would definitely be up there with other predictive factors. When we see patients that utilize our services very frequently, it's again due to it could be due to a medical issue or a non-medical issue such as a social determinant of health. But all of those issues all lead to the patient needing more care than what was planned. The goal, once the patient has an acute inpatient visit, is to get them stabilized, provide them with great care, and then transition them to a homeostasis as an outpatient where primary care can manage their chronic illnesses. When they come back to the ER, it's either an exacerbation of their illness or it's because of one of these gaps that we identified.
It's interesting that tools like LACE and the tool that you have in Epic weren't as highly correlated. You wonder if the changes in our population over the last 20 or 30 years since some of those tools might have been developed played a role in the fact that they were less well at predicting readmissions than they were when they initially were rolled out.
Yeah, and I don't mean to diminish the value of those because we do use those tools, and they're extremely valuable. They do help us to predict who might need home health services. So, somebody that has a medium or high risk of readmission with the Epic readmission tool or score, we do offer and try to set up home health services for those patients.
Okay.
So I don't mean to diminish the value of those. Those are extremely valuable, and those should not be discarded or discounted. And it wasn't a far transition from the ER visits to these. But what we found was that this was really our highest predictor that we needed to focus and lean in on.
Thanks for that explanation. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. So as we embark to try to find out the ER strategic role, we formed a multidisciplinary team. And while we focused on reducing ED readmissions, our core focus was really at our mission, which is to extend the healing ministry of Christ to our patients and to provide them with better care. So while we were focused on a metric, we wanted to find the root causes of readmissions and try to address those. Our initial team started out with regional and campus CNOs, regional medical directors from the ER, ED system nursing directors, and system care navigations and care management leaders.
Now, did
And we met
these,
once.
I'm sorry, Max, did these come from each of the eight hospital-based EDs, or did they include the freestanding EDs also?
All of our freestanding ERs roll up to a main campus. And so when we worked on these projects, we categorized them each as a hospital-based ED system. And so we took leaders from all of the eight campuses to form this committee, as well as some centralized leadership from the system.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely. And then we formed a cadence where we met once a week and we reviewed all the data from the previous week. And we looked at all upstream opportunities, such as an AVS discharge process, a pharmacy medication reconciliation that wasn't performed, primary care doctor appointment. And we shared all of this upstream opportunities. We also shared some feedback to the ER about potential opportunities that they could think about employing current resources that we had. And really, our guiding light was we were empowered to have operational and clinical oversight to remove barriers and improve our patients' care. Norm, I feel like I had a question.
I did have a question. So I have a question. The empowerment that you talk about with operational and clinical oversight, did that include the ability to hire more staff and create more resources within the ED?
Yes, it did. That's a great question. It did involve the ability to do that if needed. As a team, our first goal was not just to add more staffing. A lot of people think that the first solution to a problem is to hire more people to fix the problem. And that may be a solution, but there are many other solutions and opportunities to look at first within our own departments and our own teams. How can we work better? How can we communicate better amongst ourselves? How can we take feedback from our teams to solve these problems?
Thank you.
Our first 6 months with ED Gatekeeper was quite interesting. We started from a base of lack of knowledge, lack of engagement, and really not realizing we had a huge opportunity to play in this role. So we started with our initial data discovery as a team, and then we tried to build team culture at every one of our campuses with each of our leaders. This involved weekly campus reviews back to the teams, back to the leadership, and then asking them to give us feedback as well. Often, when we develop a process, we want to share unidirectional feedback about how to do something better. And really, we had an open mind and open hearts to find what we could do better and take their feedback to really tailor our message and how we supported them. We were able to create an epic awareness with a badge or a banner at the top, so that when a clinician opens a chart of a patient that was discharged within 30 days, there was an alert that said, "This patient has been discharged within the last 30 days. Would you like to consult case management?" And that started an awareness campaign with our ear physicians and APCs immediately upon opening the chart the first time. And the last thing we did was we started a live Epic chat support system. So when a patient came back within 30 days after they received that banner, an Epic chat, which is like a message or a text message within Epic, that message was sent out by case management to the treating clinician, but also the campus ER medical director, the chief nursing officer, the chief medical officer, and director of case management. And really, we asked their feedback, as far as what was going on with the patient, how we can support them, and what resources they might need. And when we first started, most of the time we got a thumbs up and very little feedback. As we started to build this process and solicit feedback and engage our teams, we got a lot of really great information and feedback that they could care for the patient if we had a PICC line service or midline service. If we could only do X or Y or Z, we could take care of the patient without having to readmit them. And we compiled all that data, and that's where we took that data and information and developed a lot of our processes. What we noticed over the initial 6 months is that our readmissions from the ER had reduced. We noticed that our hospital-wide readmission performance had gone from the bottom quartile to the middle quartile. And we noticed a cultural shift with our ER leadership and our ER teams. Some of the key trends we noticed was a lack of outpatient infrastructure as one of the barriers. And we noticed that we made progress, but we still weren't at our goal, which is top quartile to top decile performance in this measure. After the first 6 months, we realized that we had made progress, but there's still work to go and work to be done. So, as you asked earlier about empowering teams, we empowered our teams and asked them all these what ifs. If I had this, or what if we had this, what could we do with it? And we set up a bunch of subcommittees to look at a bunch of processes that would empower our teams to better care for our patients. This list that I'll review is not in a timeline. This is just simply a bunch of the processes that we did. Many of these were developed simultaneously. This was not a one and then next. And I'll walk through. These are the major processes. The first one is care plans. So we developed a process with care plans where if patients came back multiple times, either to the ER or readmitted, we created a care plan with case management and the campus leaders to evaluate the patient really holistically for what's going on with the patient. We interviewed them while they're readmitted in the ER, and we had a better understanding of what the patient's challenges and barriers were, so we could better address those. And those care plans were placed into the Epic chats when a patient would return to the ER. So an ER clinician that sees a patient for the first time, it's always a new patient to the ER physician. But we could share a very quick summary of this patient's healthcare journey, their barriers and challenges, and make suggestions as to what we should consider or what resources we may want to engage to better care for the patient.
Did you have in those care plans, could you talk a little bit about whether or not you incorporated the primary care physician for that patient into those care plans?
When patients had primary care physicians, we would list them as well as a contact person or even a specialist. If a patient had a cardiologist that was really critical or crucial into their care for, let's say, heart failure, we would list that service and say, please consider contacting cardiology or having them see them in the ER to manage their condition. We noticed a lot of times what looks very sick or ill to an ER physician who's seeing the patient as a new patient may just be their chronic appearance to a physician that knows them well from the community, that's seen them longitudinally. So we did have those suggestions as well in there. That's a great question. One of the processes that we did add some centralized care managers to this process. So as our process expanded and the volume of our knowledge and work expanded, we noticed a need to support our teams on a 24/7 model, not just when care managers were present in the ER or on each campus. And really, how do we have a system that knows the resources available across our system, not just at the local campus? So we were able to hire several care managers to sit in a centralized location, and they would review every one of the patients that was an ER revisit, and they were the ones that actually sent this message to the campus and to the campus leadership. They also were a channel to escalate any barriers that may be found on the campus. So if a patient needed a PICC line or midline resource that wasn't available at the campus, or interventional radiology or a specialist, they were our experts to help escalate that beyond a local campus or local ER for resources. We started performing ER dialysis, which was a process not previously performed. We engaged our nephrologist, and we've had hundreds of patients now that have come to ER and received dialysis and been able to go home safely, as opposed to being readmitted or placed in observation in the hospital. We partner with our hospitalist teams. Our hospitalists play a crucial role in the care of our patients in the ER and upstairs and during the discharge. So we actually asked them to partner with us upon return to the ER. So when a patient came back to the hospital and we were seeing them for the first time, it may be very familiar to our hospitalist patients. We've actually come up with a name for these patients now called MVPs, or multi-visit patients. And so for a multi-visit patients, the hospitalists are very adept and very knowledgeable of the patients, and often know their social situation, their medical care much better than somebody seeing them for the first time. And they would come down and perform what we would call a huddle in the ER, where they work with the ER physician and case management to try to treat the patient better. And this really enhanced our ability to take care of patients, not only for discharge, but also for admission if they had recently been admitted to the hospital. We started several infusions in the emergency department, several antibiotics where a patient would come back with a multi-drug resistant organism. And really what they needed was outpatient infusion of antibiotics. When how do you set that up from an ER? It was quite challenging. So we worked with our PICC team and midline team and infectious disease to set up pathways where a patient could have a midline or PICC line placed and had these antibiotics set up in the ER and also for home care. Placement from the ER to facilities had previously been an extreme challenge. In fact, we often admitted patients for placement. That's a very common theme across the country. And so we ask, how can we do this from our ER? And so we set up relationships with our case management team and our ER leadership teams with our facilities to directly admit patients to skilled nursing facilities, inpatient rehab, and the hospice right from our ERs. So what previously required an admission or readmission to occur, we were able to do right up front in our emergency departments. I think I already hit on ED PICC lines and midlines, and that really was critical for our infusion pathways. We started performing ER paracentesis, whether that was through interventional radiology or if it was through our ER physicians who felt comfortable doing that. And we set up IR pathways to expedite interventional radiology for our patients. And then as we reviewed all this, we really improved our revised upstream feedback. This is not necessarily a process, but this is really more of an information gathering where our teams, with this enhanced knowledge and enhanced team, started sending much more robust feedback every week to the C-suites. So every week, each C-suite continues to receive an ED gatekeeper upstream feedback where it lists the upstream opportunities, and it lists what we could have done better from our upstream opportunities from an index discharge best discharge practice. And the last major process that we worked with was with home health and paramedicine. So we have home health agencies and paramedicine platforms that provide care at home. These are used often by our primary care physicians as an outpatient, but it's not a pathway that we had engaged or used from our ER. We found novel ways to use them. So if a patient with CHF was discharged, we could have a paramedicine team come and check on them the next day. We could work with home health, where home health would actually send a patient into the ER and communicate with us, and then we would communicate with them and send them back home as more of a warm handoff, as opposed to an isolated, separate service from the ER.
Do you have a sense of which of these areas contributed maybe the most to the success of the program?
I wish I could tell you that one of these processes, was the key be beneficial area. But honestly, all of these have played a crucial role. And these are what we developed at our in Central Florida based off of our patients' needs. All these processes may not be what another system or campus needs at in your community. It's really gathering that information and getting feedback from your teams, and then developing pathways to address your local population, your care barriers. So a local community may have a great dialysis, outpatient dialysis system, and they may not need to set that up. Or a campus or system may have a real challenge with PICC lines, and they may want to partner with the service to set those up. And we've gone from admitting somebody for a PICC line or midline failure to having a PICC or midline replaced or fixed in a freestanding ED on a Sunday afternoon within 90 minutes of a need, where a service comes in and places that. It's a big, great patient satisfier, and it's also a great service for our communities.
I was going to ask you if you had a favorite story of one of these interventions that really created a life-changing difference for a patient who was just kind of always circling back into the ED or constantly getting readmitted.
Yeah, that's a great question. And well, first, there's numerous. We have hundreds and most likely thousands of stories to share about the success of this program. But I think a very common one that we see is families and patients that should go to a facility that don't really want to, or they're not emotionally ready to do that, and they get discharged home, and they realize after a few days or a week that really they should go to a facility, but feel helpless and they have no way to do that themselves. So they come back to the hospital and they come back to the ER, and the reflex has been to just admission for placement. And that's a very common theme across the country. So when we're able to take a patient and place them directly in hospice or directly to a facility, we've seen a lot of families very, very grateful for that, because we really speed up their time. They don't want to come back to the hospital and be sick again. And they're very grateful for what we can do to provide them with comfort of their family and loved ones.
That seems like a problem which you would have encountered many barriers to fixing. Can you talk a little bit about how you brought a collaboration together that was able to successfully implement that program?
Absolutely. So we're very fortunate that our ER care managers are part of our overall campus case management and care management team. So they're very familiar with the process. It was just not a process or lever that they had pulled in the emergency department, but they can implement those same processes for placement. So when that work has already been done or started as an inpatient, they can take over and carry that process forward with the families and with the facilities. So it was really just expanding our inpatient team's processes to the ER. When it first started, we had the hospitals help us out with this. One of those is signing the 3008 form, which a lot of our ear physicians were not very comfortable with at first. And our hospitalist teams were very happy to come down and collaborate with us and help do direct ER to placement for to facilities. For hospice, we partnered with them where they'd actually come to ER and evaluate the patient and talk about their needs and goals. And doing that warm handoff in the ER, and then transition to either home or to an intensive care unit or an IPU unit as an outpatient was really a key to the success of that.
Great. Thank you.
Absolutely. So our results, and we continue to improve and work on this every day. We noticed major trends of results. And we really went from the bottom quartile to the top quartile performance of hospital-wide readmissions, which took us from 16.5% to 14.3%. Our goal is to be top decile, which will put us at 10%, which is 1 in 10 patients. And we continue to be on that trajectory now. A lot of patients ask, well, what happened to the ER, or what happened to the inpatient metrics during this process? Were the ER metrics impacted negatively? Were the inpatient metrics negatively impacted? Did it hurt our volumes or our patient perception of care or our care spaces? And thankfully, we can say that we actually had positive improvements of every one of these metrics. In the ER, we noticed that our door-to-discharge was actually improved. And I suspect that's probably because of our process improvement, where these processes not only impacted our target population, but really every one of our patients. Our patient experience remained in the top quartile. Our left without treatment had no changes, and our ED vo daily volumes actually increased. Our inpatient metrics, our volume had increased as the volume of patients, as our population grows. Our inpatient length of stay remained flat or has de decreased. Our observation length of stay has been reduced, and our inpatient likelihood to recommend has stayed in the top quartile. So we've been able to maintain top quartile performance in all of our key metrics for the ER and inpatient along the way, which was a big question and concern to many of our campus leaders.
So would you say, is it fair to say that the productivity of the physicians and the APCs within the emergency department did not get degraded by this initiative?
That's correct. That was a big fear at the beginning, and probably one of the fears of why we couldn't, why we could not be part of the solution is because it would have a negative impact on our ER. They would have patients sitting in our ER for 8, 10, 12 hours as opposed to admitting them. And what we found over time was engaging with the teams, building sustainable processes, and really making this collaborative approach really led to the ER having zero impact, zero negative impact to how the ERs operate, and may actually improve the way that they operate because our clinicians were empowered with many more tools in their toolbox to care for patients. And so what we thought was a really a barrier or something that we couldn't play a part in, really what we found is that we play a really crucial role from a leadership perspective and as a service line in reducing readmissions for all of our patients and those who are age 65 and older.
Thank you for that presentation, Matt. That was great. One of the other things that I've noticed in my experience is that when these projects kick off and you've done the education of the executive team, the C-suite at regional and system levels, one of the things that can derail them is when you have leadership changes. And leadership changes, as you know, are pretty common in the hospital and healthcare industry. You've gone through a change from being a regional medical director for the ED group, Team Health at AdventHealth. Now you're a hospital employee, system CEO. Did that transition have any negative impacts on this project?
That's a great question, and that's a great point. As we set up our processes, we wanted to make this a process that was sustainable and one that was not individual dependent. So as we set up these teams and processes, there's so many checks and balances of the team, and we made sure that we had mission, we had a vision and a mission for each one of our subcommittees and the overarching committee, so that regardless of who sat in a leadership seat, that they had the same goals in line. We also performed warm handoffs. So as I transitioned from one of the ED gatekeeper leaders to the chief medical officer, there was a warm handoff to the person that took the role in place of me. And he had actually led several of the subcommittees. So he was already very, very supportive and engaged with this process.
For physician executives listening who are either at the C-suite level who are managing emergency departments, whatever their role is, what would you tell someone who wants to tackle this readmission challenge in their own system? That what are the first two or three steps that you'd recommend that they take as they start down this road?
That's a great question, and that's actually a huge barrier to most people trying to address this is not knowing where to start, right? So I think it's important that you understand where you are as far as your data. So how are you performing as a system, as a campus? So you need to understand your current data metrics. I think you need to understand your current processes and team. And then you need to solicit feedback from your team, what's going well, what's not going well. And then I think once you understand that, you can really engage a team to set a vision of where you want to go, and then ask them, how do you think we can get there, and how can I support the team in order to meet this vision? What can we do, and how often do we need to meet to make sure that we can set this vision by a certain timeline? I think if you set a vision and a timeline and you empower your teams and you solicit their feedback, I think that really will set you up for success with this or really any other challenge or problem you may face.
Great. So what would you say is the major learning that you took away from your involvement in this opportunity? I get the impression that you're no longer a unbeliever in the role that the ED can have in impacting readmissions. Is there another major learning point that you took away, Max, that you'd like to share with us?
I think a good lesson that I learned or was reinforced on during this process is really to involve your teams. There's a saying that if you want to fix a problem, you need to engage the leaders that are closest to the problem in order to solve it. A lot of times we feel that our previous experience says that a simple tactic or strategy will fix a very complex problem. And I think really if we really empower our teams and engage our teams and listen to our teams to solve the problem, that's something that was reinforced with this project and many other projects that I'm a part of. But that was definitely reinforced with this as the power of the team and the power of team buy-in.
So in spite of your transition to the chief medical officer, are you still considered an honorary gatekeeper? Do you have some kind of a little pin that you wear in your lapel?
So that's a great question. So I have not been gifted. So I'd be glad and happy to receive something like that. But so I am still involved. So I'm still an ER physician. I still work clinically. And I'm as the chief medical officer, I still receive these Epic alerts on a routine basis. In fact, I have one today with a readmission alert, which is actually a great story I can share as a success. It was a patient that returned with a wound and they had failed Keflex, an oral antibiotic, and they were sent in for a readmission. Well, part of our pathways is our infusion. So the patient received a dose of dalbavancin, which is a long-acting IV antibiotic, and they were safely discharged from the ER. And that happened, and I was able to be part of that process today.
Great. So while we're talking about the CMO role, and you mentioned that you still have a clinical responsibility as well, how are you splitting your time right now? What percentage of your FTE is clinical versus admin?
Well, I would say I have I'm a 1.5 FTE-er most days and most weeks. My role as the chief medical officer is 100% administrative, but I love taking care of patients, and it's extremely rewarding to myself. Maybe that's a selfish reason that I still want to work in the ER, but I also feel that it helps build teams and within our campus. So when I work, I get to interact with the nurses, the techs, the admitting services, almost all the campus physicians and teams I get to interact with on a clinical basis. And when I can walk in their shoes and take care of patients, it's rewarding to me and also empowers me to better support them and our campus.
What's your favorite shift, days or nights, now that you're in a leadership role?
Well, truthfully, I used to work all nights, and to me, that was the most rewarding time to work, and maybe because it was a smaller team. And I remember when I worked all nights, they said, oh, well, the leadership isn't here right now. Now that I'm part of the leadership, I'm like, what did that mean at the time? I work primarily days or afternoons, and it's solely so that I can be available for meetings the next day. So I work my shifts. I work a handful of shifts a month. I work a day shift or an afternoon shift, and that just really enables me to be present either that day and also the next day for administrative roles.
That's such a common attitude for us reformed or recovered night shift ER docs, isn't it? It's easier to work at night because there's not as many other admin people around and you have a pretty core team. And I always enjoyed those shifts because I found that, just top-notch staff and being able to really work efficiently as a team.
Absolutely. When you find a night team that's been together for a long time, they are bulletproof. I mean, they are just, they work together, and it's just a great example of working together, what can be done.
So I'd like to ask you a few questions before we wrap up here about this transition from being a leader in the emergency department, even with regional responsibilities, to a CMO role, which is now focused on one hospital. And what would you say has been the biggest surprise about that transition as it's been occurring for you over the last 6 months?
In my previous role, I had supported hospitalist and emergency medicine departments. Mm-hmm. I did not have any experience or exposure to any of the surgical specialties. And so I'm not sure if it was more of a surprise or a recognized opportunity or knowledge gap. And so when I joined and transitioned to my new role, it was very important to me to reach out to those physicians that I didn't know and those campuses that I didn't know, and be very humble and open to explain that I'm happy to be here and support them, but I also don't have a huge working knowledge of their operations or their teams, and I really needed to lean on them and to support them, and for them to tell me what I need to know and how I can support them as I continue to learn now.
There's always a tension, it seems like, between immediate operational issues. You could hear that as crises if you'd like staffing crises or other types of emergent situations that we have to deal with in healthcare settings. And balancing your attention to those things with proper attention to longer term strategic initiatives like overall quality and safety and even strategic growth. Do you have any strategies around how you're balancing that right now, or is it still something that you're learning about as you've transitioned over the past 6 months?
A great question. So the first 3 months, it's very difficult to build strategy when you're getting to know the campus, because I transitioned to a new campus in this role. So getting to know campus and the medical staff and all the leaders, and even the non-clinical leaders at the campus. So it's very difficult to build strategy the first 3 months. It's more about a knowledge transfer. How can I learn about this campus and all the processes and teams? But as I start to set out strategies, and you're right, there are crises. It takes me back to a leadership pearl that I've tried to keep, which is the better you lead, the less you have to manage. And what I mean by that is the better you lead strategy, and the better you lead your teams, the less you have to manage crises. It doesn't mean that they won't occur. They happen all the time. But it's very challenging to be always reactive and manage problems if you can help lead teams to success, set them up for success and address root core issues. That to me has been a key to success in the past and currently right now. So I try to address all major issues as they come up. I think I'm very blessed to work at a campus with a lot of empowered leaders that can solve problems. And I also try to set up strategies for long-term success and long-term sustainable growth.
Was it difficult for you to shift your focus away from the emergency department and the hospitalist programs and spend enough time focusing on those other areas of the organization which you hadn't historically been as familiar with?
So my personal experience, actually having a lack of knowledge, I think helped me to better support them because I came to each of the departments very humble and very open to wanting to learn more about them. If I had to self-reflect something I could have done better, and I felt that I supported the ER team based off my previous experience, as opposed to a clean slate, just trying to understand the current ER, I felt that since I worked in the system that I already knew how that ER worked and the processes, and I should really have been more open-minded to just listen as opposed to carrying along with my previous role in an elevated platform or elevated role. Being humble and open to the other departments really, I think, helped set up great relationships with the leaders from other departments and really got us off on a really great foot for me to support them and to lead processes that they wanted to lead to fix problems. There's one of the challenges we face is length of stay at our campus. It's a challenging problem across the country, and we're doing quite well, but we always want to improve on that. And I've never been a hospitalist, so I don't know what they can do better. I have to ask them and rely on their leadership teams to tell me how's it going, what can we do better, and what can I support. And I told them they can pick what we do, and I will help push the cart, and they can drive, and we'll get to where we need to be.
Well, I think that's a great example of how you build trust and engagement with a diverse medical staff. So that's great advice. Thank you for sharing that.
Absolutely.
So before we wrap up, is there anything that we haven't talked about that you would like to really include in your presentation, some key nuggets that you would like to share that we haven't been able to really tackle?
One of the questions we asked earlier was about choosing Pemba and whether or not to choose this program. And I want to share something that I share with my children that I think applies to us as adult leaders as well, is that the best investment you ever make is in yourself. And that could be physical, spiritual, emotional, or education or professional development. And my only regret about the Pemba program is not doing it sooner. If you're on the fence, or if somebody's on the fence about doing this program, they're going to be really amazed and happy they did it once they get in the program. I am so glad I did this program. I've learned so much, and it's really set me up to transform who I am as a person for the rest of my life. So I think it's important for people that are considering this program to reach out, seek knowledge about the program. I'm happy to be a resource or reference if anybody's of interest. And if they're unsure about the program, to come pay a visit. I've noticed this year several prospective students have come to the class. They've sat in class, they've met with current students, and spoke to those who have graduated. And once they do that, I think any hesitancy will, or any concerns will be resolved immediately.
Right. Well, Max, I want to thank you for taking so much of your time to come on Pemba On Demand tonight. It's been great having you on the show.
Yeah, Norman, thanks for having me. It's been great to speak with you, and I appreciate your time as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Max, thank you very much for walking us through the real levers behind lowering ED readmissions, using data to find the right patients, building multidisciplinary follow-up teams, and designing transitions of care that actually work for patients and clinicians. And thank you for listening to Pemba On Demand. We release new episodes bi-weekly every other Thursday. You'll find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Castos, to name a few. Hit follow or subscribe and add us to your podcast library. If today helped you, please leave a quick review and share the show with a colleague. Questions or comments? Drop them on our YouTube channel, www.youtube.com/@PembaOn-demand, all one word. To find links to connect with Max, other resource links, or additional episode links, check the show notes and visit tiny.utk.edu/PembaOn-demand. All one word, no hyphen in this one. Until next time, take good care of yourselves and keep pushing for safer, smarter, more sustainable healthcare.